These are the Target Files, discussing the novelizations and audiobooks of classic and now also new series Doctor Who stories, looking through the eyes of adulthood at our childhood memories. After all, a great Time Lord once said, "There's no point in being grown up if you can't be childish some of the time."
Hello and welcome to episode 88 of the Target Files podcast, where we will be discussing this week Marco Polo, the book and new audiobook written by John Lucarotti and read by Senior Merton. So an interesting book. Hello, it's Alex in Exeter, and happy Christmas, by the way. A book that sort of has a very, very historical plot with the first Doctor and his companions, and maybe a little bit slow and dry in some places. I think it must have looked beautiful when they shot it. What did you think of it, Mike?
Yes, can we say it's the first historical story of Doctor Who? I mean, we've got an unearthly child, but it's the first one that's based on facts we know have been written about in real human history.
I think so. Is it before the Aztecs, then? I was trying to look at because the Aztecs is like the other historical one from this period, isn't it? It's a very interesting book, because it's very dry, it's very historical, it's got actual characters that did exist with Marco Polo and the other, Lacula Khan, who's also another sort of person from that part of the world. And I think it's an interesting book historically. I just don't know if it suffers a bit from having no actual monster again. That's the problem I found with it a bit.
Put me in mind of quite a few historicals in Mr. Chibnall's most recent series.
Most definitely. I was thinking that you could quite, because you know, you've got the three companions or friends, what we call them, the Chris Chibnall bit, and you've got quite an interesting Doctor. I think this one would work very well in the Jodie period, as well as it worked in the William Hartnell period. I think that there is a lot of similarity. I was thinking between this and, you know, Demons of the Punjab, I thought there was a lot of similarities personally.
Yes, I think you can tell. This was where the remit was given for Doctor Who before we had the Daleks so early on, for it to be a more educational show for the viewer.
Yeah, I definitely think there's that, because this is a seriously historical one. It has lots of stuff to do with this Mongol race and period of the time and where people were and all the descriptions of, you know, the buildings of Kublai Khan's building. I think it must have looked beautiful if it was done well. We don't know, because it doesn't exist, unfortunately, and we hope it does exist somewhere, because it must have been shot beautifully, because the descriptions in the book are what keep you really listening, to be honest.
Yes, we had the wonderful, we've got some wonderful, I don't know if they're colourised pictures or they were actually taken in colour in 1963 when this was filmed, but it was recreated, of course, famously a scene where William Hartnell has a sort of bit of a go at Carol Ann Ford in Adventure in Space and Time. This is they recreated some of the sets for that, for the Mark Gatiss docudrama.
Oh, yeah, I was wondering what that bit was that from that bit. It does look, when he did it for the Mark Gatiss docudrama, it did look rather wonderful. And I think if it could be reanimated, I think you could do a lot with the whole sort of palaces and the desert scenes and sort of make it look very Lawrence of Arabian beautiful these days. You know, 3D sort of animation. I think that one is definitely after the Matt Quatera was to do. I think this one should be done, I think.
Yes, I'm somewhere in between wondering whether, as a novel, looking at it purely as a novel, whether it's more of a sort of leisurely stroll road trip almost for the Doctor and his companions, but there is, I think, some great elements of intrigue within.
Yeah, I think it is quite leisurely in the pace. You have to keep with it, because there's a lot of, you know, them going off, you know, Marco Polo and going through the desert, going through all different parts of this part of the world, and it has a very sort of relaxed, slow pace. Well, for a winter afternoon, it's quite a nice film. I was enjoying it this afternoon. And yeah, I think it does have more of that sort of road feel where not a lot happens, but there's a lot of sort of political intrigue. Book, it sort of, you know, has lots of sort of conversations between different people, like, you know, Marco Polo and all the sort of people he's around affect his mood. And a lot of the time he comes over as the villain, I think, sometimes, Marco Polo, where he is towards the doctor trying to capture him. So I don't know if he knows, really trusts the doctor for the whole of this book, I think.
Yes, he is sort of quite blind sort of bandit way, sort of almost blinded by Kublai Khan's presence, isn't he, towards the TARDIS team?
Yeah, I would say that, because he wants to give the sort of TARDIS as a present to Kublai Khan to make himself more important to him, basically, and that sort of blinds him to what he could do with it. You know, and as, you know, Ian tries to tell him, you know, he tries to be honest to him, saying that this is actually a space and time machine, and he doesn't sort of buy it.
No, you know, the old idea of a caravan, that's a lovely turn of phrase.
Yeah, I think the sort of space caravan is a beautiful bit, I think, and I think that's what makes this book good, because there's a lot of beautiful wordage in it, and I think there's some beautiful descriptions of what, you know, Luca Rossi gets out of the book, basically. I think, you know, it's so, the book feels very visual to me, to be honest.
Oh, I quite agree with that, Al, and, you know, considering we don't have the visuals, I think it's one similar to The Edge of Destruction that the TV script writer has gone on to adapt into a book some 20 years later, as this was released on the 11th of April 1985.
Yeah, that is a while since the episode aired, and I think that sort of time distance has given it a bit more of an edge and a bit more interest, I think. And I think it does work, like with Edge of Destruction was a really good book, which we discussed before, but I think that might have more going on. I think the only thing I like more about Edge of Destruction, Marco Polo, is it just doesn't seem a lot going on. Though a lot is going on, it doesn't feel like a lot's going on. That's the problem I have with it.
Oh, is that this one you mean, or Edge of Destruction?
No, Marco Polo, Edge of Destruction has lots going on, that's why I think that kept more of my interest.
Yeah, but it does sort of, I don't think I wavered too often listening to it. It wasn't one I'd want to listen to straight all the way through, as we have done with some Target adaptations.
Well, I did actually listen to it straight through today. We're not about a couple of gaps for lunch now, and I think it does work if you do listen to it straight through.
Yeah, some of the side characters. Al, do you feel we've had the argument with the crowded TARDIS in the most recent series that there was enough for the companions to do? I think Susan has a pretty gentle, good relationship with, oh, what's the lady's name? Escape me now. The
one who escaped me is what I know you mean.
It's the one who Rita Xenia Merton played in the Ping Cho, isn't it? Ping Cho.
That's it. Yeah, Ping Cho.
Yeah, there's a good build-up of a friendly relationship between those two. But do you feel Barbara and Ian were isolated at all?
Ian has to do by, you know, bringing her back to the village and all that. And I think Barbara has enough sort of intrigues. I think sometimes the whole argument with three doesn't work. I think it doesn't with this. I think because they always have sort of good bits to do. They do work, I think, the whole three of them.
Yeah, I suppose it is divvied up, if that's the word, between the three of them. But you can definitely tell that the main focus are Susan and Ping Cho. And I suppose the Doctor takes a little bit of a backseat, more of as an observer than a participant, you know, losing the keys to the TARDIS. Who are the most important characters? I suppose you'd have to look at Degana.
I'd say Degana and Marco Polo are more important than the Doctor in this, I'd say. But the Doctor is definitely there. He has sort of importance. But I think, out of the Doctor's side, I think Susan does the most, I think, in this whole book.
Yes, I want to talk about the lovely audiobook performance. She sadly passed away since she recorded it earlier this year, which is also such a shame. I've seen written online as she sounded so vibrant within the reading itself, Xenia Merton.
Yeah, I thought it was a really good performance on some front. I don't know if you got the Doctor quite right, but I think, you know, her sort of intonation and sort of happiness of recordings, but was definitely there, I think.
As you say, not getting the Doctor quite right, is that partly because he doesn't seem to be such a central character within this story?
Yeah, maybe. I think that is a thing, because he is, again, in a backwards character. He's sort of observing more than actually doing, I think, for the whole of this story.
Villains-wise, what did you make of Degana?
He's sort of okay. He's sort of a not bad villain. He's sort of, you're not hoping he gets caught out or anything. I don't know. I think it was just sort of, he didn't feel that two-dimensional. In fact, very sort of flat and sort of comical villain. I'm there. But I think there are some nice bits, you know, where he tries to stop them from getting to these sort of oases of water and sort of slitting some of the people's throats. I think it has a little bit of menace, but not a great deal.
Yes, this was the first time I'd either read or listened to this adaptation. I've watched one of the Telesnaps reconstructions of this sadly missing story before, and I always knew Degana had some sort of fate at the end, but it seemed to come along quite suddenly in the book. It is written differently than it is in the TV version.
does creep up on you the way he, you know, gets killed off in the book, really. And I think that's quite nicely done in the book, but I haven't seen any of the telly snaps, but you hope somewhere in the world there's still these episodes still exist, or maybe we can get an animation in the next year or two. But I think the way his fate of his character was nicely done in the book, I think.
Just want to say from TARDISwikia.com, spoilers, folks, that Degana is killed by an arrow in the novelization, this audiobook. In the TV story, he is killed himself with his own sword.
Yeah, maybe the arrow thing is nicer than the sword, I think, because the sword is sort of, you know, he's deciding his fate, well, this is an arrow, you don't know who it is, really.
Just further dramatic license, do you think? Do you think that would have worked if he'd fallen upon his own sword, I suppose?
Maybe.
I suppose the metaphor there is he's fallen upon his own sword as well, isn't it?
Yeah,
in the TV version.
Sort of been caught out, and I think Kubla Khan knows who the villain is, I think, so he sort of... I think the arrow thing works slightly better, I think.
And some other mildly amusing character names. Wang Lo. I think I'd be introducing myself to that person saying, how's it hanging?
Oh, yeah, I know. It's very tempting, isn't it? It's some great sort of, I don't know if they're sort of Chinese or Tibetan names all the way throughout this book.
And did you like the intrigue of the idea of the Doctor playing various games? Can't remember. Is it always against Kublai Khan in order to try and get the keys back?
I think so, yeah, and there's a whole lot of the chess games at the beginning of the book which are really interesting, sort of showing their power, really, and that whole sort of description of that chess set sounded gorgeous, really. And I think there was a lot of games where, you know, the Doctor is trying to always be in control, but Kubla Khan knows what he's up to, basically.
I mean, it's a testament to the early writing and the fact that Hartnell's Doctor seems to be a very patient old soul. You can't imagine somebody like Capaldi enjoying having to play all these games against somebody to get the keys from the TARDIS back. I think he'd be rather irritable more quickly than Bill at this point.
Yeah, I think so as well. I think, you know, this is a very well-mannered Doctor. We don't get these. I think the Jodie or the Capaldi Doctor would have had the keys off him in about 5 seconds, basically. But I think they did it that way just to add more intrigue. Because how many episodes was this when it was on TV? Is it a long one again?
It is 7, Al, yeah.
Ah, blimey, that makes it. And of course, that for 7. I don't know if it would work as well. We'll have to see if we ever see it. 7 episodes is a lot.
Well, we have the existing audio with the telly snaps, and it does draw you in, as this audiobook does, on the reconstruction. So, you know, hopefully there's various rumours of it having been found already, and it may be held up in rights, or we shall see, I think, in the next few years, following the Macra Terror coming in March 2019, whether we'll see some more animations.
I think something is going to happen with Markipelago, because I know that was the whole thing when, you know, Web of Fear and that was found. That was the real big thing they were going to announce, I think, Markipelago being found, and then it sort of went really quiet again. So I don't know what's happened there, but we will see, hopefully. And then people can see if they think it's as good as they've always said, because it's always been, you know, if you get into discussions with Doctor Who fans, it's always been a sort of, you know, this is one of the best ever. And I've never, you know, I don't know if it is or not, but I think the book is very good, though.
People apparently, before Enemy of the World was discovered, weren't so sure from the existing audio and telly snaps whether it was going to be one of the sort of top stories of the Troughton era. But since we've had the recovery by Phil Morris 5 years ago now, it really has come across well on the TV screen. You know, some superb direction, a beautiful aerial shot of Troughton on the beach in the first episode that really set the scene. So it'll be another interesting facet if these episodes are recovered to see how they come across when we have the whole package.
Oh, most definitely. If we do find, they'd probably be cleaned as well by the revisitation team. So, yeah, it'd be lovely if we could get this sort of, you know, because we are very sparse when it comes to William Hartnell stuff, unfortunately, on DVD. I know there's not a great deal, unfortunately.
Yes, Al, back to the audiobook. How did you feel about the sound design? Not a huge amount of sort of musical, sort of relevant to the situation the characters are in cues, but some sort of mystical sort of, I can't think of the instrument now they used to play at the beginning of the Rank films, you know, the big drums, the sort of
kettle thing. I know,
yeah, kettle drums, aren't they? Yeah, there's quite a lot of that to sort of signify the Eastern setting.
It's a nice sort of soundscape, because it's not too intense. So I think, you know, a bit with the horses and sort of, you know, the desert was quite nice. But I was getting a little bit annoyed with the chapter endings, basically. So you knew every time you got to the end of the chapter, you were going to get that piece of music, so that slightly annoyed me. What he's got sort of used to it, unfortunately. I think, yeah, the soundscape is quite good. I think the desert bit was really good, and the sort of horses and all, it gave you that sort of feeling of being in a big space, I think.
Are you a fan of the jolly sort of, it's almost to me like a Merry Men Robin Hood-esque tune that always plays into the end credits now?
No, to be bluntly honest, no, it's horrible. I think they should just stick with a piece of the Doctor Who music, personally. It's sort of really, it seems to be this thing they've come up with for the end of all new BBC Doctor Who audiobooks. It's been a very jolly, very happy sort of piece of music they stick out, and I don't like it, to be honest.
Yes, it can give you too much of a tonal shift from the main thrust of the stories themselves.
Yeah, I think definitely, because, you know, it does have quite, you know, a nice ending, and you sort of want to end bit, and then you get suddenly jarred into being happy by this sort of very pearly people. It's a very bouncy, sort of old school BBC piece of music, and I just think it does jar you, unfortunately. Yeah, it's a very good story. I was engrossed. I listened to the whole thing in one go, so it must have been good if that kept me without looking at my phone a great deal. So I think it's got a nice story. It's historically interesting with Marco Polo and finding out a bit more about him. The Doctor wise, he's a bit in the background and the companions do more than him, so I think that can be a bit disconcerting. Soundscape was pretty good. Reading was very good, including probably her last ones he did, and you wouldn't have known that because she was very bouncy. Very good as the women characters. Yeah, so I think I will give this a 7.5 or whatever, I think.
Full of lots of intrigue. TARDIS team split up, very similar in that respect to something that Chris Chibnall has been aiming to go back to within the most recent series. Split up. The Doctor more of an observer than a participant this time. Quite menacing villain. Moves along at a brisk pace, not brilliant, but a decent sound design. You know, we've had a little bit of a moan about the music on the end, but that can't detract from the whole thing itself, so I'm going to stick to a 7.5, the same as you, Al.
Well, that's good, because I think, you know, as you know, the audiobook is, you know, the only thing, unfortunately, we've got, you know, because of not having any episodes. I think the audiobook does a very good job, so I would recommend it, because it's only recently come out, I think. It came out last week. But, yeah, I think the audiobook's very good, and it's, you know, it's a shame she's died, of course, but I think there was a really good reading of it, so I would recommend it. I think people should go out and listen to it. It is a good book.
Yes, Xenia starred as Ping Chow in this story as a young lady in 1963 when filmed, and appeared as the registrar back about a decade ago, who married Sarah Jane Smith in The Wedding of Sarah Jane.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. Yeah, well, she was good in that as well. And I think, you know, the actual bits of the audiobook she's very good at are her characters she played in the episode, because he obviously knows the character very well, and I thought they were really good. So, yeah, it's a shame, you know, since she's died, but, you know, I think her reading is very good of it.
This is Alex Gibbons' Doctor Who News Round.
Hello there, this is Who's News with Alex on the 20th of December 2018. First thing to mention is the season finale of season 11 got the grand ratings of 6.65 million, which for a Sunday episode is a very good rating. Overall, the whole season has done extremely well, with good ratings, including catch-up, of about 8 million per episode, which in the modern season is a very good high rating for a Sunday drama. On the 2nd of December, which is my birthday that week, this episode was 18th for the whole week. Unfortunately, it's been announced that the TV director Bill Sellers has died. He did for Doctor Who, the Celestial Toymaker, and also worked with Colin Baker on The Brothers and with Peter Davison on All Creatures Great and Small in the UK. He died at the great age of 93. From BigFinish.com in 2020, I know a while off but worth waiting, we have The Sins of Captain John. Back, of course, played by the great James Masters, who of course is known from Spike from Buffy, but of course as Captain John in Torchwood, and it will be a very interesting romp, and it will be a great Big Finish 4-story box set, January 2020. From BigFinish.com, released this week, is a new Benny Summerfield short stories collection called In Time. It's read by Lisa Bauman, the great Benny Summerfield actress, and it's to do with her being 20 years at BigFinish.com this year. It's lots of short stories that are connected to her past and present, and written by such great writers as James Goss. There was also a premiere of the New Year's Day episode of Doctor Who. The whole cast were there, and there has been rumours circulating that the mysterious monster that's mentioned in the trailer might be a Dalek, but nothing has been confirmed. Also there, having photos done at the BFI, was Katie Manning, who is, of course, Joe Grant, or Iris Wildtime at BigFinish.com.
Me and you were discussing this earlier, Al. Do you think it's going to be a disappointment if it isn't one of the Pepper Potts, shall we say?
I think personally that it's going to be a certain Pepper Pot villain, but I think, as I said earlier, if it's not a classic villain, the Twitter sphere is going to melt down. You know, some people will want to murder Chris Chibnall if it's not a classic villain, because, you know, he did this very clever thing. I think it has worked, of bringing his own monsters in for his own first season, and I think that does work in some ways and didn't work in some ways. You know, it's the whole Torchwood season one thing where things work and things don't work, and you pick out the things that don't work, and then you come up with an even better season for the next season, which fortunately we're gonna have to wait till 2020 for now, which is a bit of a gap. But you know, maybe we might get Torchwood next year, but I wouldn't hold out, you know, any hope there.
Yes, there were various tweets from people at the screening. It's obviously been embargoed as in terms of full-on review so far, that the special was actually quite amusing as well, so I do wonder about the villain, whether they've written it in a jokey sort of manner. That's a little bit of a concern to me, but people, you know, have been quoted saying it's one of the better festive specials, we should call them now.
Well, yeah, because like you, I have concerns, because I just don't think Chris Chibnall can do comedy. He's not the greatest at comedy, so maybe that is more directing from, you know, Wayne Zipp, with maybe Bradley Walsh getting him to do some comedy or something. But yeah, I don't know, because we got it down to, I think we got it down to four, didn't we, best Christmas episodes, and I think that's all there has ever been, I think. The Christmas episode is always a bit of a difficult one.
Yes, talking of down to four, Al, we had the results of our poll. We picked our four favourites from season 11, and there was quite a shock win for me for The Witchfinders as the best episode from our viewers.
Really?
From our listeners, yeah.
I wouldn't have put that as the favourite person, obviously, because it was quite good, and Alan Cullen was good. I would have personally put it as the Ghost Monument out the best out of those four, personally. Well, that's just me, because that's interesting.
To me, it's almost the best of the rest, because I thought Rosa and Demons of the Punjab were so well tied together, it was almost going to be a best of the rest. But the listeners have spoken, have voted, so thank you for that, and The Witchfinders is the number one.
Definitely, that's great, and thanks for voting. Well, do you think you would have thought differently if they've actually gone with the original schedule for The Witchfinders? Because I know that was meant to be in a different order, wasn't it?
Can't remember exactly when, Al. Which episode would it have preceded or been after?
I think it was meant to be originally. I think it was meant to be Demons of the Punjab, then The Witchfinders, then the one that was in the space after Demon of the Punjab, after The Witchfinders, I think.
Ah, very interesting. So I think that would have been an excellent run.
That would actually fall on like Halloween, I think, and that might have worked better then.
Because was it Kablam we had following Demons?
Yeah, we had Kablam, which is I think that one's going to be one of those episodes you'll come back to and actually like more, I think, Kablam.
Yes, very, as we spoke about on broadcast, very reminiscent of a McCoy type caper story.
Yeah, definitely very much like The Greatest Show in the Game. I think that one has got better with a bit of time delay, but The Greatest Show has, and the fact it still looks, as we both watched and we reviewed it last time, I think, you know, we watched it and it looks still very good to this day. So I think Kablam will get like that, I think. But yeah, that's interesting to see people like The Witchfinders, because I did like it, but I wouldn't have put it first. I probably would have put it fourth, to be honest. That's how I would probably put The Ghost Monument, Rosa, and then Demons of the Punjab was my top three.
Yes, Al, I want to put something forward to you based only on speculation, I should say. There were a few people before Christmas suggesting we wouldn't have a full series in 2019 on various forums, but they did seem to be some of the people who really weren't happy with the direction of the show, season 11. And it has come to pass, there won't be a full series now in 2019. But a few of them also said around that time that it may be a reduction in episodes again, and that has concerned me a bit if we go down to 8 or something.
I've seen that as well, about the reduction in episodes for season 12, and I think it's not a good idea. I think you won't be able to get as much story arc, and I think that's, I have to put this out there, I think it's slightly suffered from not having a story arc this season. No less than 10. It has to be 10, I think, because you get squashed in this. You can't get everything into like 8 episodes in a Doctor Who season. I think it still needs, I would personally like it still to be 13, where you've got lots of space to breathe. Because I think there's a lot of episodes this season just gone where they were too tight. They didn't have enough room to sort of elevate them to something even better, I thought.
does make me wonder when an arc is an arc in full, OAL. Would you say it has to be seeded sort of throughout mid-season as well? As we did have Tim Shaw returning from the initial episode, but there was no big cliffhanger in the penultimate episode going into it.
I think an arc is allowed to be an arc as long as there is a connection in somewhere. So I don't think you need to have it going all the way through the season. But I think it would have been nice to have maybe more references to the Tim Shaw characters, maybe more than the first and the end, and kind of building it up. I think, you know, the tension can be built up more by just little references. Like we had with the whole Bad Wolf thing, and, you know, the Chris Eccleston period. You didn't know what it was right to the end, but it was sort of very subtly built up through the whole season. I think that adds tension.
Yes, Al, another bit of news I only spotted released earlier today. We are going to get an adaptation of one of the stories that was never Target novelised, Resurrection of the Daleks. But the CD version is actually down for a whopping £33.99 on Amazon for pre-order, so people are speculating whether it'll be a print version along with an audiobook CD version.
I hate to say it, but I would that price will be a lot better. When's it coming out? Because that's the pre-order price on Amazon. I've had the same problem with the last Anne Rice book on Amazon, where they stick an absolute humongous price on it, and then it will hopefully come down. Who's reading that, just out of interest? Because I haven't seen it. I saw it on Twitter earlier, but I haven't seen anybody saying who was reading it.
Actually, no audiobook confirmed as of yet, but I'm trying to recall if the writer has been named. I shall just have
a look. That's Colin Baker period, isn't it? Resurrection of the Daleks.
No, that is... Resurrection is on Peter Davison in the.
It's the last Tegan. It's the story when Tegan leaves, isn't it?
In the London Docklands.
I know which one you mean now. Presume that might be Peter Davison then, because he seems to have a habit of reading his era books. He like with his end story. You know that was read by him, wasn't it?
So Andrew Zali recently. We shall have to speak about that one at some point.
We will do. It's because it is a very good audiobook. I've already got that, and it's a good book. Yeah, I think normally with Peter Davison here, he reads them himself by the looks of it, or Nicola Bryant does them, because he covers both, doesn't he? Because he covers Colin's era and his era, so he sort of does. Or I think Mark's. So I think it would be nice, because Janet Fielding's now back in the business. It would be nice if she read it. Now, you know, Big Finisher have got her back, so, you know, it would be nice if she did it for that, as it's her last actual Doctor Who, you know, in the classic period story. That would be nice if she did it. Anyway, what have you been doing out of the Who land? What media things have you been watching?
Oh, it is down, sorry. Resurrection of the Daleks is down as being written by initial TV writer Eric Saywood, so that'll be very interesting.
That will be good.
And
by Eric Saywood.
I was mistaken in thinking it was April. It's the 4th of July, American Independence Day.
4th of July, that's why the price is so much. It's like 6 months away. Amazon have a very naughty habit of doing that with audiobooks. They steep up the price, making people buy them. So, out of the Who world, what else have you been watching, reading, Joys of Christmas and all that sort of stuff, Mike?
A friend of mine managed to get free tickets for what I think is a wonderful film, the biopic of Laurel and Hardy on tour in the UK in the 1950s with Steve Coogan as Stan Laurel and a magical turn by John C. Reilly, who's already been nominated for a Golden Globe, as Oliver Hardy. Just gonna say it's a BBC Films production. It's really got the tone of those biopics they've done of great British comedians in the past, like Tony Hancock, the people from Steptoe and Son, Hattie Jakes. Just a superb film throughout recreations of the 1950s. You know, elements of their sort of slapstick act brought in within the story itself, in terms of you see them having various sort of moments when they're checking into hotels in the UK and everything, but also a bit of a melancholy, as there was a bit of a rift that had developed previously between them in that period, but not overly sentimental, but just a thoroughly enjoyable film with two great central performances, some great performances as well. Shirley Henderson from Love and Monsters Doctor episode, as she was Oliver Hardy's young wife at the time. But that's going to be so recommended by me. I think it's out on general release in the cinemas around about January the 10th. It's called Stan and Ollie. Go see it.
Yeah, it's on my list of January, when it's cold and wet, the film's going to see it, because I've been wanting to see it for ages. I've heard really good things about it. But is it, the problem I have there now, you say it's a BBC thing, is it sort of the thing what should just be on TV and not at the cinema then?
Debatable, Alex. I had that feeling maybe as I was watching it, but I think scale-wise, you know, you get a lot of their sort of routines in theatres and places like that, and perhaps there wasn't the best use of a cinema sound system. So I would be leaning towards thinking, yes, possibly just a TV film, but benefited for me from being on the big screen. But, you know, it's something I would like to go and rewatch whenever it turns up on BBC.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a good watch. I'm going to go and see it in the cinema when it comes out next year. And, you know, I'm into Oscar season in January, of course. There's lots of things to go and see. I want to go and see Green Book. I want to go and see the Vincent Van Gogh film, what's coming out. I can't remember the title of that is now. There's lots of things for the Oscars. I think the Oscars are even early. So I think they're like the end of, either the beginning of February or the end of February. They've moved them forward, I think, a bit. So that's really interesting. I'm trying to think, what else is the rest? We know we're into that sort of Christmas period of semi-good TV. I don't think the BBC and ITV have done enough this year, bluntly honest. I think they're a bit lacklustre. On Christmas Day looks terrible. You know, I think I will be watching stuff on Netflix probably on Christmas Day, because there isn't a great deal. There's good stuff around the time, like Great New Watership Down, which looks very good, and there's a very interesting version of the Agatha Christie book, ABC Murders, with John Malkovich. He's doing a very sort of interesting outlook where, you know, he's not British and he's not, you know, Belgian, but he's been in Britain enough time to sort of get the mannerisms of being in Britain. So I think that looks really interesting. How about you, Mike, at Christmas?
Well, I was talking about John Malkovich. Will he have a moustache as good as Kenneth Branagh in that movie?
Well, apparently not. He's just going to have, because he's doing this play in America where he had this sort of very sort of good sort of bit grey beard and sort of looked quite Poirot's his director, so don't shave off and do that, basically.
I'll be doing a usual rewatch of some Christmas classics, you know, already seen Muppet's Christmas Carol in the last few days again.
Has that been on? I think I've missed it. That is so good.
It's actually where I work with people with disabilities. We put it on for them this afternoon on the big screen, so.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation, of course. I've got a lot of podcasts with their Christmas specials to catch up on. Blah Wars, the Star Wars one I went to see live last month. There's the Betamax Video Club. They've done Christmas Vacation recently. I've got that stored up to listen to. This Smirsh Pod, the excellent James Bond one, they've actually gone and done. On their second season, they're looking at Michael Caine films, so I've got their look at Muppet Christmas Carol to look at, which also features the special guest, Stephen McIntosh, who was in that movie, of course, as Scrooge's nephew.
Oh, yeah, that is Stephen McIntosh. So it catches up before it starts. I've been watching Luther, where I had Stephen McIntosh in as well for the first season, and that's been very good on Netflix. For the new season starts on New Year's Day, I think that starts.
Yes, we have Doctor Who at 7 o'clock and Luther at 9 o'clock. Not sure what in between, probably soap.
Both really good things. Well, yeah, that's what I'm watching with mainly on Netflix this week, is to catch up with Luther. But yeah, apparently the Muppets Christmas Carol, which is brilliant if you've never seen it, with Michael Caine in being Scrooge. It was the third most watched Christmas film, apparently, after Elf and then It's a Wonderful Life, apparently.
Overly keen on Elf, I think. Possibly I'm just a generation above it, so.
Well, I think I'm the same, because I don't think I've ever seen it or been really into it. I've seen A Wonderful Life 100 times, it's fantastic. And Muppets Christmas Carol, it's just, you know, it has every box ticked. You've got Kermit being cute, you've got Michael Caine being his great self. It is just brilliant from start to finish.
And the songs are fantastic, you know, given it.
You have to be pretty hard hearted not to come out of that film humming or singing those songs, really. They are just brilliant.
And it was the first film they did Henson after Jim died, of course, and it's just such a great tribute to him, the fact it's a classic all these years later.
Oh, definitely. And I think, you know, there is rumours what Netflix have just got this, well, planning to do the prequel to The Dark Crystal, aren't they, from Jim Henderson, so that would be rather interesting next year. But I think this film just came out, Jim Henderson along, and it's just beautiful and brilliant fun.
1992, Jim died in 1990, and 1992 Christmas this was released.
Yeah, well, I think his daughter now runs the whole Henderson company. I think that's what's happened since then, I think.
Going through the generations, and we can be pedantic and say that when these performers move on, the voices aren't quite right, but
Well, it's an interesting one now, thinking that that isn't the old generation now. I'm not going to hear the same Kermit the Frog voice we know from the Muppets Christmas Carol, including somebody new now.
Yeah, but I suppose it's been nearly 30 years since Jim passed, so it's been a while.
And the sort of, you know, the question is, has there really been good Christmas stuff since then? That's the point, because we all seem to go back to the stuff, don't we? Like, you know, I've been re-watching The Boxes of Lights, and that came out before I was born, but it still hold really good Christmas feel to it.
Amazed it's never been remade, but, you know, who could match up to Pat Troughton as Cole?
Well, this is the interesting thing, because about I think it was about 2-3 years ago, there was, you know, when the Chronicle of Narnia films became really big again on the big screen, there was talks of doing a big Box of the Lights. And I think, because it's so complicated to do, I think it sort of died a very quick death, basically, the idea did. Well, I think the actual BBC one, which is so well directed, so well, you know, acting there, you got the great Pat Trout and all the other people at the time, and the music, which has just come out on Silver Screen Records, is absolutely stunning still, I think. And it's an interesting one, because we seem to end up, you know, loving stuff from that period, and I don't think I could quote much on this time period what I would watch again at Christmas.
If you had to recast Cole, if they did a movie version, who would you go for?
I'd probably go for Eddie Redmayne would be quite good, thinking about it. Eddie Redmayne would be quite good, or maybe Ben Kingsley, somebody like that, maybe. Maybe somebody, you know, sort of big Ben Kingsley, or Ian McKellen, maybe.
Yes, I'd put those two in. I probably think Ben Kingsley would be a perfect fit. But left field, I'd go for Capaldi, just to keep it Doctor Who.
Yeah, well, I was going to say Tom.
Ah, you know, of course. But
he would be awesome for trying to be that sort of very mad magician.
Absolutely, Al. So next time, are we just going to do the New Year's Day, or are we going to do a book as well, or just do the New Year's Day special?
I think we'll just do New Year's Day, because I think that will take up enough, basically. And then, did we say Caves of Androgyny after that?
Caves of Andrew's Auntie, yeah.
Andrew's Auntie, I can never bounce the blooming thing.
Next time, Doctor Who Target Files. We'll be discussing the 2019 Doctor Who New Year's Day special, Resolution, written by Chris Chibnall and directed by Wayne Yip. You can contact Doctor Who Target Files on Twitter at DW Target Files handle, search Facebook for our podcast page and leave a message, and please do rate and review us on iTunes. Thank you so much for listening. Doctor Who Target Files, Marco Polo Review, featured Alexander Gibbons and Michael Winks. 13th Doctor Theme, composed originally by Sagan Akinola. Version for the podcast by Borna Matosic. Please do check out their YouTube channel, BORNA MATOSIC. Doctor Who Target Files, Marco Polo Review, was recorded in Exeter, Devon, England, and Swansea, Wales, UK, during December 2018.